The date is Thursday, October 12, 2017. The time is 11:08 a.m. This is a hearing of the District of Columbia Rental Housing Commission. Location of the hearing room is Suite 1140 North, 441 4th Street Northwest, Washington, D.C. We're here pursuant to D.C. Law 6-10, Rental Housing Act of 1985 as amended. I'm Chairman Peter Sagdy-Mazak. I'll serve today to chair this hearing. With me today on my right is Commissioner Diana Harris-Epps, and on my left is Commissioner Michael Spencer. We have one argument today noted for hearing at 11 a.m. regarding the housing accommodation located at 301 G Street Southwest. The tenant petition number is RHTP1530615. The case is styled Awad Mahmood, Tenant Appellant versus Capital Park Towers, LLC, Housing Provider Appellee. The commission notes sua sponte that it had inadvertently and erroneously added Arlena Cheney to its caption in this case in the notice of the scheduled hearing and notice of certification of record dated September 12, 2017 and in its notice of request for settlement negotiations dated September 12, 2017. The commission recognizes that Arlena Cheney did not file a notice of appeal with the commission and that Awad Mahmood, in the absence of any statutory regulatory authority under the Act, incorrectly added Arlena Cheney's name to the caption of this appeal in his request to add name to certificate of service dated August 30, 2017. As a matter of law, the commission determines that only the tenant appellant, Mr. Mahmood, is the appellant in this appeal. The commission regrets its inadvertent captioning error. Furthermore, the commission's sua sponte determination renders the housing provider's motion to strike the name of Arlena Cheney as an appellant moot. The commission notes that there are parties seated before it and would ask that you identify yourselves for the record, beginning with the tenant appellant.
Good morning. I'm Kimberly Fahrenholz. I'm one of the two counsel for the tenant petitioner, Mr. Mahmood, who just walked into the room and is raising his hand for the record.
Robert Pfefferman on behalf of the tenant petitioner.
So you both are representing Mr. Mahmood?
Yes.
Okay.
Good morning. Vincent Policy for the appellee, Capital Park Tower, LLC.
Good morning, Mr. Policy. I'd briefly like to explain our procedures. Our rules are similar to those of the D.C. Court of Appeals. Each party will have 20 minutes to present its case, beginning with the tenant appellant. The tenant appellant may reserve up to 5 minutes of your 20 minutes for rebuttal. Following the presentation of the case by the housing provider appellee, the housing provider appellee must present all of your arguments within the 20-minute time frame and will have no rebuttal time. In its discretion, the commission may allow additional time for argument to a party in the event that we engage in questions that occupy a substantial portion of your time. The commission's hearing will be recorded on an audio CD. It will be issued in writing and sent to the parties within 45 days of this hearing. In this proceeding, the commission does not request nor will it accept post-hearing submissions from either party. Please turn off any cell phones or other electronic equipment. I'm going to ask this in the interest of administrative efficiency and the prompt resolution of this appeal. I respectfully ask each of you whether there's any interest now, before argument, to settle this case or to enter into settlement negotiations. We have a very experienced settlement attorney on staff, and we would ask both of you have to agree, not just one party. So, Mr. Policy, we'll begin with you.
I honestly have to say no to that, Mr. Chairperson. We're always willing to receive a settlement offer from Mr. Mahmood, but we do not believe it would be productive to delay these proceedings in order to do that.
Okay, sir. That then ends that discussion. Before our arguments, the tenant appellant may may request time for rebuttal following Mr. Policy's presentation. How much time do you request?
We would request 5 minutes.
5 minutes. Okay, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Please, Tenant Appellant can commence the presentation of your case.
Okay. This petition that is 3615 was filed on December 29, 2014. It named three individual tenant petitioners, that is Mr. Shavemaker, Ms. Cobb, and Mr. Mahmood, who's present today. Arlena Cheney had also put her contact information on the first page of the petition as a representative for the New Capitol Park Towers Tenants Association, which was also listed on the first page of the petition. On March 20th, 2015, petitioners then filed a notice to identify all parties and a list of, I know there's some dispute, but we believe it was 51 tenants.
Can I just cut to the chase real quick?
Sure.
What exactly is your issue on appeal?
So we have a couple issues that are noted in our notice of appeal. We had about
there's no brief accompanying the notice of appeal, correct? So you're going to make the arguments here?
Yes. Okay. Yes. So first of all, the OAH denied the association party status. It found
which. Okay, now this is where it gets tricky.
Sure.
There were apparently two tenant associations, one incorporated in 2005 and one formed in 2014. The registration records, as I understand it, was simply included the 2005 tenant association, albeit there was apparently meetings that created the 2014 tenant association and that had officers, et cetera. So is this really a question of which of these two has standing to?
I don't think so.
Okay.
And I'll tell you why. I think that the OAH, and I should phrase it that we contend that the OAH made an error when it went into any of those details at all, because what the code says, and this is DC code 3502.16A, says that, and it's A2, all you have to do is have one or more tenants who each have standing individually. At least one has to have standing individually. And then there needs to be written authorization for the association to represent the members.
I understand that those three tenants were not members of the 2005 tenant association. Am I correct?
I think that is what the landlord contends.
Was there any evidence in the record to support that they were?
Our contention is that it wouldn't matter because they could be a part of any organization.
That then means there's no formalities to create a tenant association anymore. Is that whatever was done in 2014 was the functional equivalent of what happened in 2005 when there were such formalities?
Well, again, our position is that those details shouldn't have been even investigated because, subsection C of the same code section that I just cited says that there should be no further inquiry into the membership of the association. And so, therefore, any group of tenants, as long as they have written authorization from the tenant body, should be able to present a case before the Office of Administrative Hearings.
So how do they know that the tenants that authorized them are in fact tenants of the housing accommodation?
Well, I mean, they presented a written form, and you can go back to Petitioner's Exhibit 184, which was filed June 24, 2015. The form actually has a printed name, a signature, a date, an apartment number, phone number, and it simply states, I am a tenant member of the NCPTTA, and I am in support of its efforts with the association. It further goes down, and it states, you know, for any of the three tenant petitions, one in 2006, 8, and 2014.
Didn't the OAH judge determine that that was ineffective, that the that kind of authorization simply was not legally sufficient?
Yes, and we believe it was an error.
Okay. So what precisely is the issue in this case?
Well, as I mentioned before, there's several issues. I mean, one is the issue of standing and whether or not this organization...
Now, you're representing Mr. Mahmood.
That's correct.
Okay, so we have to remember who you're representing. Where was Mr. Mahmood in 2005? Was he a member of the 2005 tenant organization?
That is correct. He was a member.
He was. Okay. Was Mr. Mahmood acting on behalf of the 2005 organization or the 2014 organization? Because I understand that there's internal conflict because of there was a TOPA issue here, and one organization decided to allow the housing provider to engage in it, the other opposed it, and that's what this split created, this split. So I'm just wondering, wouldn't it be reasonable to suppose that Mr. Mahmood is really representing the 2005 organization, which is the only one that's of record in the files of DHCD at this point, HRA?
Well, I'm not sure how to answer that question, but I think that on this issue we're contending that Mr. Mahmood and the other tenant petitioners were representing the 51 members that were signed on to this motion to amend the tenant petition and add these petitioners. And so at the very least, an organization was created with a formality that revolved around getting them to sign these petitions and informing them of the action that was taken and what they were consenting to. And so what we're saying is that there was an error to not just amend the tenant petition, to add as an association these 51 members as represented by members of that tenant association who were the parties to the petition.
Independent of the otherwise registered or identified 2005 group, and independent of whatever new group was developed in 2014. And so your argument is that when OAH was presented with these 51 people, rather than trying to fit them into one group or another, they should have just independently made a determination that this is a bona fide group of residents of this building who have come together on behalf of themselves to present a case. Is that correct?
I couldn't have said it any better myself. That's exactly what our line of thinking is. And if you'll turn to the cited case of Borger versus Lee, she actually goes contrary to the rationale of that case in saying that the point of a tenant association is for judicial efficiency so that groups of people can raise the same concerns in one action. And she says that, well, these people are free to, raise their own 51 individual actions, which is the kind of prescription that the hearing examiner makes at the end.
Okay.
In addition to this issue, there is another issue that I think is kind of stronger and more important in this case, which is the denial of the motion to continue on the September 20th, 2016 hearing date. I think that that's just an arbitrary, capricious decision that was made by the ALJ. There would be no prejudice to the housing provider to reschedule that hearing. Counsel had just been appointed in that case. Ms. Fahrenholz had just been appointed in that case, and the hearing examiner seemed to give not enough credit to the motion that was filed for that September 20th hearing. I think that was, you can find plain error in that decision.
But that's a discretionary call for one, and secondly, her grounds were that Mr. Mahmood had several months to file this, and in fact, Ms. Fahrenholz appeared on the day and that it was the opportunity lost over an extended period of time that she determined was legitimate not to grant a continuance when there had been such opportunity before that day to file for a continuance, especially when Ms. Fahrenholz appears on the day. There's not even any notice. She makes no notice of appearance. It's just like the captioning in this case. You add a name and you suppose that it's okay. It's a discretionary call, so it's not an evidentiary call. And so you're claiming it was an abuse of discretion, and I understand that. Ms. Commissioner Spencer has some questions.
Yes, yeah, I want to hear your explanation to the question he just posed as far as the abuse of discretion.
Yeah, so what you said there about giving that there were several months to file that, I'm not sure that determination was ever made in her order. She said that they had a chance to file it, but I'm not sure. I couldn't tell from reading the order why she felt that there were several months that they could have filed this motion to continue. My understanding was that this was the first continuance that was requested, that the case had been prolonged for months because of problems with OAH and problems with both parties and motions that were filed. This long saga with the tenant association was one of the reasons why it was continued for so long. I don't think there would have been any prejudice to allow Ms. Fahrenholz to get more apprised of the case and be able to present at the evidentiary hearing.
And I'll just add to that issue, the two continuances that were made in the case were one where the ALJ had an injury, and so she continued a hearing. There was the other continuance was actually requested by the landlord, and it was because they couldn't make the September 19th hearing. So they rescheduled it to September 14th. So the ALJ had made some findings on the record on that hearing on September 20th that tenants had asked for continuances, but they hadn't. I think there's one entry on the docket where it indicated that the tenants were requesting the continuance, and they had not. So that's an error. Further, I think that if you look at the facts in the cases that are cited, like Wall versus Watkins, the facts are completely divergent in that case. In that case, yes, the tenant had an opportunity to try and get counsel from the time of the first hearing to the time of trial and didn't. Mr. Mahmoud did and came with counsel and then asked for a continuance at the hearing. It was his first request for a continuance. I had just been retained during the month of August. The ALJ even goes as far as to attach some pleadings that I had drafted in the other case, which we were trying to consolidate for the purposes of judicial economy, that show that I had been making filings in that case. I think that is also evidence that, yes, I was doing a lot for these tenants and had a lot on my calendar, and therefore I wasn't able to act quicker. I think she uses that to sort of lend credence to this idea that I hadn't acted, in good faith, but I think it shows the opposite. I think it shows that I was acting in another case, and I can't do two things at once, unfortunately.
It seems to me,
I understand your point. I just want to understand, how does that become abuse of discretion?
Well, it becomes an abuse of discretion because it's the first time the tenants had asked for a continuance, and Mr. Mahmoud had come with the diligence of already finding counsel. We stated on the record that the reason that we chose not to present evidence that day was because we were candidly not prepared. There was 200 exhibits that had been submitted in June of 2015, and, I hadn't had an opportunity to go through those exhibits. So on top of it, I had a conflict with a hearing in the landlord and tenant branch. That hearing was, based on another estate case where I was acting as plaintiff. It created some problems in that case, too. But, you know, I wanted to appear to show the ALJ that I intended to help Mr. Mahmood and proceed. And I think also by presenting the motion to continue, the motion to consolidate, we show that we were really trying to work in judicial economy and trying to merge these cases together. And if you look at the OAH rule, the OAH rule does not require the parties to be the same. It just requires that, you know, the respondent be the same. And in this case, the respondent was the same. The issues were a little bit different. There were some different parties, but actually Mr. Mahmood was in both cases. So it probably would have made sense to consolidate it.
I think, going to your question of abuse of discretion, I think that you can find abuse of discretion by looking at the Murphy factors here in Murphy versus A.A. Barrow, which is referred to here by the hearing examiner. She goes through them in her analysis. You can use the same analysis in terms of abuse of
discretion. We're running out of time.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Last question for you, too, is in that you mentioned having a conflict as far as a case across the street as well. And she footnotes that suppose he started at 10 a.m., but you remained at OEH to 11:30. Can you elaborate on that point?
Yes. I mean, you know, the commission may be familiar with the landlord and tenant branch and how they have a very, very long wait. So your hearing might be scheduled at 10 o'clock. But it may not be heard until 1 o'clock.
Okay.
And unfortunately, that's just kind of what we're dealing with the volume of cases over in that branch. That day, I had a continued further initial hearing in the state matter where I was acting as a personal representative. You know, I had told the other party and the clerk that I had another matter.
Okay,
and so that's how I was able to straddle the two.
I understand. Thank you.
Commissioner, do you have any questions?
I do not.
I have one more. Why didn't you file an interlocutory appeal on October 29th, 2015, since almost all the issues you raise really arise from the order denying motion to add the tenant association as a party?
I think that's a very good question. First of all, I would say that these tenants were acting pro se. They had an experience doing the exact same thing in their 2006 case, where they had been denied the same opportunity for the tenant association to be recognized as a party. They lost that appeal, and they weren't able to proceed. And so I think they had one previous bad experience, and so they felt like it was fruitless. I mean, you know, you could ask the tenants themselves, but that was what I garnered from, you know, just representing them for these last several months.
All right, thank you. Mr. Paulsy?
The District of Columbia law provides authority to tenants associations to represent others. It provides non-lawyers the ability to represent the rights and to bind others. This is a very serious authorization, and I think we need to be careful that the people that are claiming to represent the tenants actually do represent the tenants. And that was the problem here. From the outset, the tenant petition failed to meet the law because the DC Code 42-3502.16a requires a written authorization from the person supposedly represented. There was no such thing in the tenant petition. The regulations require a statement to be filed with OAH stating that the tenants consent, who the tenants are. That didn't happen either. So the tenant petition failed from the outset, and Judge Pearson noticed that. And that's what culminated in this hearing. She insisted on that compliance with the law and nothing more, and the tenants resisted it. There are two things that we need to be absolutely clear on here. The tenant petitioners were not contending that there were two tenant associations. They were contending that they represented the new Capitol Park Towers Tenants Association in 2005, and that these other guys, Mr. Horn and Mr. Williams, represented some other tenant organization, 2014. Judge Pearson held very clearly there are not two national or new Capitol Park tenant associations. There is one, and it's the one that's in 2005. It was incorporated in 2005. So let's clear that up. There was no question that there were two of the same named tenant associations. The problem that Judge Pearson uncovered here was that the three tenant petitioners did not, as they claimed, they were not officers of the 2005 tenant association. They were not members of the 2005 tenant association. There was testimony at that hearing. Arlena Chaney testified at the hearing. She had never been elected president of the 2005 tenant association. Now, faced with that testimony and faced with these facts, Judge Pearson concluded that these people were claiming something falsely, that they were not officers when they claimed to be, that they were not members
when they claimed to be. Did you just say that at the hearing below that Ms.
I'm sorry, could you?
Did you just say that at the hearing below, Ms. Chaney's testimony was offered to establish that she was not a member of the tenant association, is that correct?
She testified she was not the president of the tenant association. She was acting in capacity of president of the tenant association, which she was not.
But Ms. Chaney was not a party, is that not correct?
She was not a party at all.
So the relevancy of taking that representation of Ms. Chaney, how would that in any way factor into Judge Pearson's determination with regard to the three named parties? Was there any specific information presented by your side with regard to the actual status of the three named parties, notwithstanding Ms. Chaney's lack of status?
Yes, and Judge Pearson held exactly what you're saying, that Ms. Chaney was not a party to the tenant petition, and so that was irrelevant. She claimed to be the president of the tenant association and testified that she had never been elected. But Judge Pearson did hold, and it's in the written decision, that the three tenant petitioners were not members of the association, that they claimed to be what they called floor captains, an office of that tenant association, and that they were not.
I'm sorry, and who presented that testimony? Well, how did that evidence come in?
The two witnesses that testified at the hearing that...
Your witnesses, is that correct?
William Horn and Michael Williams,
who were essentially at odds with the 2005 group at the time, is that correct?
Not at odds. They had been found by the Superior Court in the Conversion and Sale Act case to be the directors of the tenant association.
It
had already been decided.
The 2014 tenant.
Of the 2005 tenant association. There is no 2014 tenant association. There is none. So they were both claiming to be officers of the tenant association of 2005.
I see.
The point is that the judge found that none of these three petitioners were members, officers, agents, or otherwise of the 2005 tenant association. The creation of the 2014 tenant association was a facade. It was a fiction. There was no such thing.
And the testimony presented by the two witnesses who had been found by Superior Court to be officers of the 2005 tenant association was what went into the record unchallenged. Is that correct?
That's correct. It did. So what was Judge Pearson to do? She found that these people were not what they claimed to be, that they had no connection with the tenant association. Well, what do we make of the fact that written authorizations were submitted? They were kind of garbled,
Didn't she make all of her representations on the case presented by the housing provider?
No, Ms. Chaney testified.
Ms. Chaney, who was found to have not been completely truthful nor an officer, is that correct?
That's correct, yes. But she made her determinations based on the testimony of tenants, namely Mr. Williams and Mr. Horn. Mm-hmm. What of these authorizations? These authorizations say, I authorize the New Capitol Park Towers Tenants Association to represent me. These people were not that. It's circular to say that they were being authorized by those because the authorizations say that the New Capitol Park Towers Tenant Association was authorized, not Mr. Mahmood, Mr. Schabemaker, and and Ms. Cobb. So those authorizations of 51 people, the judge correctly said, they don't qualify. They don't qualify for several reasons. Number one, it's not to the tenant association that you're authorizing is not here. Secondly, they were not entered into before the filing of the tenant petition. And that's what the statute requires, that you can, the tenant association can file a tenant petition if it has been authorized, not that we sort of make this up as we go along. So the fact is here, these people were claiming to be representatives of a tenant association, and they were not. And therefore, they were not authorized. They did not have standing, and the judge correctly ruled that that the tenant association could not be named as a party for those reasons.
Doesn't this resemble Borger, where it was the folks who showed up at the hearing regularly who were given standing because there was questions about the legitimacy of the tenant association? So, for example, if Ms. Cobb had not shown up at the hearing, in all likelihood she wouldn't have been given standing, because she, the appearance, it's the appearance that created the standing, not, and then the testimony on that one is a tenant that goes then in on the record rather than in, so that Cobb, Schavenmaker, and Mahmood get standing because A, they appear for the hearing, and then B, that they claim that they are tenants of the, and it goes on there's no conflict that they are tenants of the association.
They had standing as individuals. Yeah. They did not have standing as representatives.
Right, and that's why she. That's why she. That's the reason that the. That's the reason that the caption on the order denying motion ad tenant is Tracy Cobb, Schavenmaker, and Mahmood tenants.
And she held that they were the only petitioners, and went forward with the hearing on that basis. But there is a point underlying this that's before this commission. Mr. Mahmood had no relationship with the tenant association, the New Capitol Park Towers Tenant Association. But yet, the notice of appeal purports to say, well, the error was making him make authorizations about the New Capitol Park Towers Tenant Association, and then excluding that tenant association as a party. He has no standing to raise that. He acted, as Judge Pearson correctly held, as an individual tenant petitioner. He has no standing before this commission to raise something on behalf of the tenant association. The Court of Appeals held in Spire versus Berry that you can't assert somebody else's rights, and that's what he's trying to do. The only party that could appeal the denial of the tenant association as a party is the tenant association. They filed no notice of appeal. So you have a basic problem of standing of Mr. Mahmood raising this in the first place.
Let me just ask you this. Mr. Policy, what I understood Ms. Fahrenholz to say was that that's immaterial, that as long as Mr. Mahmood is a tenant and that's proven and he claims to be acting on behalf of the tenant association and he is a member of that association, then that then opens the door for the tenant association to become at least a putative party, and that's how I understand Ms. Fahrenholz's argument.
He was not a member of the tenant association.
He wasn't.
He was not, and the judge found that. And the statute requires that these actions be taken by members of the tenant association. What kind of chaos would we have? Let me back up a second. What kind of chaos would we have if any member of the tenant association, against the wishes of the officers, directors, and members of the tenant association, could file an appeal? It's the same as occurred in Stanton versus Gerstenfeld. The tenant association has certain rights. The individual members can't exercise those rights. If we do, you have appeals contrary to the wishes, contrary to the authorization of the tenant association, and that's what you have here. So I don't think they're standing, even if he is a member, and let alone when he's not a member. So I don't think that the, I don't think that those issues are before you. In terms of the lack of notice, which is issue number two, everybody knew that that hearing that occurred, that where the judge was going to decide what who was what and who was going to be the party. Everybody knew that because the judge said, direct your attention to the judge's June 23, 2015 order, which said we need to have a status conference to discuss these issues. Right on top was the tenant association. I said in a pleading subsequently that we knew that these people were not officers, directors, or members of the tenant association, and that was a filing of July 29, 2015. That hearing followed. Everybody showed up with witnesses. So to say, I didn't know, that's a, just another excuse. And the ultimate excuse was showing up on the day of the hearing and saying, well, we can't go forward. After 2.5 months of notice, after almost 2 years of this tenant petition pending, to show up on the date of the hearing and say, I'm not prepared. For the judge to deny that is not a, an abuse of discretion under the case law for numerous reasons, and not the least of which is that when motions are made on the day of trial for a continuance, the Court of Appeals has said, we are loath to question the decision of the trial judge, and that is Taylor versus Washington Hospital Center, 407 Atlantic 2nd, 585, 1979 case. The case that that the judge cited, Wall versus Watkins, was the same thing. The tenant showed up on the day of the hearing and said, I'm not prepared. I'm not prepared to go forward. And the judge said, you have to go forward. I'm not going to give you a continuance. The Court of Appeals upheld that. The court has also held that the recent retention of counsel is not good cause. Davenport versus the Rental Housing Commission, 579 Atlantic 2nd, 1155, at 1157. These excuses, if they come earlier in the process, a month before the trial, are one thing. But on the day of trial, the courts have held that overturning them is not something that the court is going to
can
do.
I
it's not an abuse of discretion.
Can I ask you a question? Are most of the issues here, don't most of the issues here really originate in the order of October 29th, 2015, aren't most of the issues raised on appeal really issues that emerge from that?
What order is that?
That's the order denying motion to add the tenant association as a party.
I think that's the focus of the appellants, but there are two phases of this. The first is who should have been the parties, and the second is should the case have been dismissed. When Mr. Mahmood files 200 exhibits, was there at the housing accommodation during the entire time that these things were alleged, waits 2 years to retain counsel. Counsel shows up on the morning of the hearing, about an hour before the hearing is supposed to start, and said, I haven't had a chance to look at anything. I'm too busy. And then says, I'm supposed to be in landlord-tenant court, and then stays at the hearing. The court, I think, understandably and correctly said, this is not acting in good faith. This is not acting promptly. This is a last-ditch attempt to continue this case, and I'm not going to allow you to do it. I think the judge was within her rights to say that. It was certainly not an abuse of discretion to say that, and I don't think there's any basis for saying that it was. The judge had two choices. When she said continuance denied, proceed, she could have let Mr. Mahmood defy her order and say, I'm not going to proceed, and then what? Or she could say, if you're not going to proceed, I'm going to dismiss your case. He went out in the hall, he had another opportunity to consider it, he came back in and said, I'm not going to do it. At that point, the judge had one choice. If you're not going to proceed and I'm not going to grant you a continuance because I think within my rights, your case is over with. And it was. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Do you have any questions, Commissioner?
No questions.
Commissioner? Thank you, Mr. Policy. Ms. Fahrenholz.
Okay. Yeah, I just want to address quickly this standing argument. You know, this is something that I feel that the housing provider has raised a lot. Nobody has standing to sue. If this is a complicated legal argument about which tenant association, who was a member of what, despite a sheet being submitted by the tenant saying that I want to sue my landlord for certain violations, they feel like there's violations against it. Despite signing that sheet and having 51 people who are tenants of the housing provider sign the sheet saying I want to sue, still nobody has standing to sue. I mean, if it was up to the housing provider, nobody would have standing to sue the housing provider. I don't understand the legal argument that he's making about the different. I don't understand how that relates to this.
Can we talk about when he mentions the how chaotic it would be if you could host hypothetically 10 associations at the building? What are your thoughts on that
argument? I agree. It would be terribly chaotic. It would be a chaotic situation. That's not what happened here. Here you have tenants signing a piece of paper, 51 individual tenants saying, I am authorizing you to sue on my behalf for this particular action. I think that when people are operating pro se, I think we met the requirements for that statement to say that I want to sue in this particular action and I am granting standing. I feel like that's, you can't get any clearer than that to say that I want to sue my landlord, I am granting authority for you to sue on my behalf.
And as far as Mr. Mott's membership in a tenant association, how do you respond to that?
I'm not going to make any representations about his involved membership to the various different tenant associations. I will say that he was clearly a member to the association of tenants that were filing this action, which is before the court today. He was a member of that a group of people, that organization, or however you want to style it. I think that it would have been more appropriate to just style the association with a name that encompassed those 51 individuals rather than trying to tie it back to the original 2005 tenant association or the 2014 tenant association. I understand that this would, it would be chaotic to have different tenant associations, but it's not chaotic to have particular tenants associating to take a particular action, which was happening in this case.
So you would agree that the 51 people that sought to sue the housing provider had individually or collectively could have done that, independent of what the officers of the tenant association wanted to do, whether they as an individual tenant could do whatever they wanted to bring suit, as opposed to misrepresenting themselves as representing the tenant association and its officers.
I think that that's correct, and I think that that's what they were trying to do in this action, however clumsily they may have been doing that. I think.
So that's when the chairman went back to that original pleading. What was the date of that pleading? That October was an October pleading. Mm-hmm. The October pleading, when the controversy was kind of parceling out whether there was a tenant association or, at that time, was your client represented by counsel?
No. I don't believe so.
Not in this matter, Your Honor.
So at that time, when Judge Pearson was deciding whether there was or was not a tenant association, he and the other three people were completely pro se.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct.
And I will say that, there's been representations made that Mr. Mahmood was not a part of the organization, but if the commission takes a look at Exhibit 184 that was, filed in June 24, 2015, his signature is here.
So I guess I have to just stop you, counsel. Your argument is kind of, I thought you were arguing like no, you can't have it kind of both ways. I mean, I thought what you had argued was that when the case was initially filed, he was not representing in any way the tenant section, but rather himself and 51 people who were also tenants. So whether he was or was not a member of that association would have no bearing on their individual ability to sue the housing provider as this group of 51 tenants. Is that correct?
Well, I think that our argument is that we are trying to assert that there was written authorization by a tenant organization. Although I think that I think you get it correct when you say that there were groups at odds. And the problem with that scenario is that I think we've all heard anecdotally that there's, you know, conflicts between tenant associations. But, you know, the legitimacy of an association, I think, goes into play that they are going up to bat for their members' rights. They are doing something to help their members. They're filing something to help their members. And regardless of who they are and you know, what their organization name is, they should be able to do that with this new law.
But, isn't it a fundamental precept that there was a name established in 2005, and then there's another name established in 2014, and there is, if you overlap them, then you see that there's no necessary identity of interest, no necessary identity of membership, etc. So that you have a question of which one is, for legal purposes, the tenant association that represents, under our current regulations, the tenants, because it followed the correct formalities to create a tenant association. And then, so you have this kind of issue emerging again. I keep going back to October 19 because a lot of these issues could have been resolved earlier, in fact, most of them. Because they all emerge from the determination of who is the correct party here. And ultimately what happens, if there's questions, and you can see Borger, because I wrote Borger, is that it's the people that show up when there's a conflict, when there's a conflict in the representation. And so Mr. Mahmood was and Mr. Shavenmaker and Tracy Cobb were there to protect their interests as well as the interests of the tenants, the tenants they thought they were representing. I think one question I have, and before my colleague enters, is I think part of what Judge Pearson was saying is, look, each of these tenants, we're not talking about common areas here. We're talking about individual units that have individual problems. And a tenant association is, you know, in its commonality, is not there to act as kind of the, you know, a class action place where each person has their own gripe. And the tenant association then presents 51 gripes that are different from each other. Some are similar, some are very different. So I think her point was that there was very little commonality in the what she read to be the issues confronting each of the tenants distinctly, and that the tenant association is not an appropriate mechanism to bring a case like that. Each tenant should bring a case because it's really an individualized complaint. What's your response to that?
I think there were. I get my only response. Maybe Ms. Farenholz can add is that my only response would be that there were sufficient common areas that were at issue in the case to make the tenant association an appropriate party.
And I'll just add to that the tenant petition in this particular case talks about common areas. There was renovations that were being done on the lobby area, the laundry area, the elevators, and, you know, all the tenants had similar gripes, in the words of the chair, in that regard that could have been discussed all in one hearing. I understand the commission's position on, the difficulty involved in having a hearing on 51 different gripes in 51 different units. I think that, sometimes the problems were similar in that, the tenants, complained about things like hot water or cold water. These are problems across units that may have been considered in one hearing. But yes, I think, the problem with having representatives, but then also having complaints that are, unique to each unit, like code violations, I think that those things would probably require specific testimony by that tenant and couldn't be dealt with in a representative fashion.
Commissioner.
No more questions.
Commissioner.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Well, that brings to an end this hearing. I appreciate very much, and we do